The original podcast was recorded in German. This podcast was translated using artificial intelligence. Burn Rate, the Venture Insider podcast with Max Meister.
Hello and welcome to Burn Rate, the Insider podcast. I'm here talking with Guy Jafredi about the startup scene with a focus on venture capital. We're recording on Tuesday this time, a bit earlier than usual, and it's the 25th of November at 6 in the evening. This podcast is sponsored by our partners, Ara Ventures and Wenger Valley. Guy, welcome. What are today's topics?
Yes, today in the news we have the mega round, the 50 million Series A from the AI robotics startup Flexion, then Switzerland as a spin-off nation in the European ranking, and of course Google catching up in the AGI race with Gemini 3. For our deep dive, we have Bernhard Trusch, managing partner at Everstride Partners, joining us to look ahead at M&A transactions of venture-backed startups in 2026. The listener question comes from Niels from Chur, and he wants our take on the State of European Tech 2025 report from Atomico. And to close, as always, we'll cover the most important transactions of the week.
Exactly. Let's get to the first news items. And this one is truly exciting for all robotics and AI nerds. And it comes from Zurich. Flexion Robotics has just raised $50 million in a Series A, and they're building nothing less than the brain of humanoid robots. That's exciting. Flexion takes a clear platform approach, meaning they're not building the robot itself, but a complete autonomy stack, language understanding, motion planning, full body control. The idea is that robots should behave like autonomous agents, without scripts, without teleoperation, and without those typical lab constraints everyone knows. And the investor lineup is remarkable. I'll read it off quickly. DST Global Partners and N Ventures, that's NVIDIA's venture arm. Then Process Ventures, Switzerland's Red Alpine, and Moonfire. For a deep tech robotic startup in Switzerland, that's a serious signal. And the question is, what does this mean for the European or Swiss AI robotics ecosystem? Flexion wants to deliver the intelligence layer for humanoid robots, essentially the operating system of robotics, while other startups build vertically integrated robots. How strong and how exciting is this approach from your point of view?
Yes, that's a good question. I honestly find the approach extremely exciting because it targets the weakest part of humanoid robotics so far, adaptive autonomy. Many robotics projects have impressive hardware, but on the software side, they're often massively overfitted. They work well in demos, but in unstructured environments, things get difficult pretty quickly and they don't perform the way you'd want them to. A horizontal approach like Flexion's is more scalable. If you abstract the brain layer, you don't have to rebuild control loops, motion primitives, or safety logic for every single robot model. That reduces complexity and increases the chances of adoption across OEMs. The downside, you depend heavily on the speed and reliability of hardware partners, and you must prove that your software can really generalize. But the market is large enough that a dedicated autonomy player has a clear place.
Can a source code first company in Zurich really be successful? And where do you see the biggest risks from a VC perspective?
For me, Zurich as Flexion's base is no coincidence. You've got ETH, the AI center, and a talent pool in robotics and AI. Companies like Anybotics or River and many others, it's become a real cluster that's visible globally. Robotics, AI, mechatronics, it's truly a melting pot here. Why it can work, you have top talent in control, planning, agentic systems. The ETH proximity makes recruiting much easier. And we have an investor scene that really understands deep tech. As for risks, first, humanoid robotics has extreme capital requirements. This is not a 10 million problem. It's easily a few hundred million or even billions before real scaling happens. Second, as I mentioned, hardware dependencies. If OEMs deliver slower than expected or run into technical bottlenecks, the entire software stack is delayed. And third, go-to-market risk. You must show that you don't just have a great demo, but a stack that runs reliably in factories, warehouses, or service environments.
Yes, but overall, Flexion now has exactly the investors who are willing to take these risks, as you said, and that's a strong signal for Switzerland as a robotics hub. Let's move to another piece of news that is important for the Swiss ecosystem and also strategically relevant. Startup Ticker reported this week that Switzerland is among the leading European countries in spin-offs from universities and research institutions. European deep tech and life science spin-offs have created around $400 billion in enterprise value and more than 167,000 jobs. And Switzerland stands out. ETH Zurich, EPFL, the universities of Basel, Zurich, Lausanne, they all consistently generate new high-quality startups, often with global impact. For us as VCs, that means the pipeline for unique deep tech cases remains strong. But the competition for pre-seed and seed rounds is getting tougher because international funds are watching these developments extremely closely. Since Switzerland is so strong in spin-offs, what are the central drivers behind this?
Let's mention three structural factors. First, talent quality, ETH, EPFL, and the life science clusters in Basel and Zurich are absolute top tier in Europe. Every year, an incredibly strong stream of highly specialized researchers comes out of these pipelines. Second, technology transfer structures. Switzerland has TTOS that actually work. Clear frameworks for IP transfer, licensing, support with founding, early company building. In other countries, that's often a serious bottleneck. ETH has standardized much of this now, which is excellent. Third, capital access in deep tech. We have several specialized funds, family offices, and corporate programs that actually understand deep tech. That's a major strength of the Swiss model, and the funding fits the kind of innovation created in spin-offs here. The combination of these factors makes spin-offs not only possible, but scalable.
I mentioned it earlier, and this is good for us as VCs, but how do you see it? Competition is getting stronger, or do you also see opportunities?
It's both. There's more competition at fund level because international funds are now watching Switzerland very closely. Pre-seed and seed rounds are filled much faster and are more competitive. Strong teams often have oversubscribed rounds and valuations are correspondingly high. But at the same time, access to unique projects is increasing. Every year, more spin-offs are created and the variance is getting bigger. As an investor, you get access to technologies that are truly unique worldwide, especially deep tech with real scientific IP. That's extremely attractive because it's hard to copy and can't simply be replicated by a venture builder. The key is, you must be early. You need strong relationships with professors, research labs, and university ecosystems. Whoever is embedded there gets the best opportunities. That's currently a massive advantage for local Swiss funds.
Great. Let's move to the third news item. Last week, there was a real shockwave in the AI race. Google, with Gemini 3, has for the first time in years clearly overtaken all competitors. According to the Wall Street Journal, the new model outperforms ChatGPT and Anthropic across more than a dozen benchmarks, in some cases by a large margin. That's remarkable because Google was considered the AI sleeper for a long time. Internal silos, slow releases, strategic uncertainty. Now we're seeing the reversal. Sundar Pichai has apparently reorganized the company successfully, and Sergey Brin is back in the daily business. Gemini 3 performs extremely well in reasoning, multimodality, and tool use. User numbers reflect this. Gemini went from 450 to 650 million monthly active users in just 3 months. And as the WSJ wrote yesterday, investors had basically written Google off. But now they're calling it a massive AI comeback. For many in the industry, it feels as if Google finally regained its search engine moment. But this time in AI, Guy, when a model suddenly dominates all benchmarks, how much of that is real structure, organizational excellence, and how much is just compute?
Before answering, AI sleeper train is a top expression for Google. And yes, they are definitely awake now and going full speed. I'd say it's a classic 50-50 split between compute and talent. Compute alone isn't enough. Google had that before. The real difference is that for the first time in years, Google worked in a focused, aligned way with clear governance. The silos, search, DeepMind, research, product teams, those were the biggest problem. They were fragmented and sometimes even competing internally. These teams have now been brought together under former DeepMind leadership, and they're all pulling in the same direction. With Gemini 3, you can see what happens when you have a unified architecture, a shared training pipeline, and a shared evaluation framework. Huge effects.
The leap in benchmark performance isn't just the next model generation. It's the result of alignment and execution within Google. And yes, Sergey Brin's return was, in my view, a decisive cultural impulse. He brings back this "it has to work" mindset. And honestly, I downloaded Gemini 3 and was really impressed by how different it is, not just compared to version 2, but even compared to ChatGPT. I can only recommend everyone try the 30-day free version. It's wild. They've done genuinely great work, and I'm extremely curious to see how things evolve.
This episode is presented by RA Ventures, the Bern-based business angel club. RA Ventures connects ambitious Swiss startups with experienced investors who offer far more than capital, a strong network, real expertise, and hands-on support for the decisive early steps. If you're a startup looking to grow or an investor seeking access to the most exciting early-stage deals, apply for our next event at www.raventures.ca. Wenger and Vielli, your partner law firm for startups. Whether founding, financing rounds, or exits, startups face complex legal challenges. Wenger and Vielli supports founders at every stage with tailored advice on corporate law, financing, tax matters, and IP protection. Wenger and Vielli, your legal counsel for startups.
Let's move to the main topic. Today, we're looking at something that will play a key role in the venture ecosystem in 2026. Maybe even more than fundraising, more than AI hype, more than all government programs combined, mergers and acquisitions. If we look at the past 2 years, the M&A market for venture cases has been a roller coaster. We've seen big trade sales, fire sales, and a huge number of deals that never made it into a press release. Multiples have become more heterogeneous. Buyer segments are shifting, strategics are consolidating more aggressively, private equity has regained appetite, as we've seen recently, and at the same time, founders and investors' expectations are rising to finally see real exits again after years of hesitation. Today, with our guest Bernhard Trosch, we're doing a quick review of 2025 and an outlook on 2026 with a focus on M&A of venture-backed companies. What are the real price levels? Who is buying and why? And how well are founders actually prepared for an exit? Bernhard Trosch is managing partner at Everstride Partners, one of Switzerland's emerging M&A advisory firms. Everstride specializes in tech and venture cases, both buy-side and sell-side. They work at the intersection of corporates, mid-cap companies, investors, and startups, and they see an enormous number of deals from the inside. So they know very precisely how transactions are evaluated, negotiated, and structured today. Everstride also works frequently with founder teams going through an M&A process for the first time and therefore understands the tension between vision, emotion, and reality extremely well. We want to talk with Bernie about what the market currently looks like, how 2026 might unfold, and what founders should do now to professionally prepare their exit without drifting into wishful thinking. A quick disclaimer before we start. I'm on the board of Everstride. Bernie, great to have you here. Let's dive right in. Looking back at 2025, which M&A transactions in the venture space were the most defining from your perspective?
Hello, everyone. Hi, Max. Hi, Guy. Always a pleasure to see or hear you. Thanks for having me. To your question, Max, what were the most defining deals? For me, there were three major ones in Switzerland. The first is Yokoi, definitely an interesting story. There had long been talk about a potential transaction, and this year it happened with TravelPerk. It's interesting because Yokoi was a VC-backed fast-growing company and TravelPerk is also a VC-backed platform. They joined forces and for Yokoi's shareholders, this marks a new journey together with TravelPerk. Structurally, it's an interesting deal and shows many founders what's possible within the VC ecosystem itself. The second noteworthy transaction was Beekeeper with Lumapps. Beekeeper had been around for a long time, a very successful scale-up in Switzerland. There had been rumors for years about a potential exit. Here we saw a merger with Lumapps, along with a sponsor, Bridgepoint, a private equity firm that essentially acquired both companies almost simultaneously. Again, structurally interesting. two companies that were not direct competitors, but highly complementary, joining into one platform. They now have new scale, new opportunities for international expansion, and with Bridgepoint behind them, significant potential for further acquisitions to consolidate the market. And the third major deal was Lakera, acquired by Checkpoint Software. This is a more classic trade sale. Checkpoint is a public company, very corporate-like, and Lakera showed what's possible with AI-driven companies. Founded in 2021 and already acquired by a strategist for $300 million, at least based on public reports. This was also a real breaker deal this year and will likely trigger further transactions.
Exciting. And all three of these deals we've covered on Burn Rate at some point this year. You can find those episodes on Spotify if you're interested. We didn't miss anything, Max. Lucky us. Let's look at multiples in tech and deep tech exits. How have they developed? Especially if we look at enterprise value to revenue or EBITDA multiples, what do you actually see in the market?
It's a very split market. Since 2021, there's been a clear distinction between high-quality companies and, to put it bluntly, the rest. For software companies, a common metric is the Rule of 40, the combination of revenue or ARR growth plus EBITDA margin. If the sum is 40% or above, you're in the top cohort. If you look at the multiples, companies below Rule of 30, meaning growth plus EBITDA below 30%, drift strongly downward in valuation, typically around 2 to 3 times ARR. Companies at 30% or above, the uplift starts already there, even before 40%, usually trade at 7 to 10 times ARR, sometimes higher. So the divide is extreme. You can see it in process speed as well. Rule of 40 plus deals move quickly and with strong pricing, whereas companies outside that bracket face slower, heavier processes and lower valuations. The appetite of buyers is equally bifurcated.
Looking ahead to next year, which three structural trends do you think will dominate the M&A market in 2026?
One thing we've been seeing for several years is that strategics increasingly use M&A to force strategic shifts within their own organization. Not just organic moves, they use acquisitions to enter new markets, new products, new features, new customer segments. That's definitely a trend that will continue in 2026, especially in tech. Things are evolving extremely fast. For corporates, it's becoming almost impossible to keep up organically. That's why a lot is happening through acquisitions. This will continue to be a major driver next year. Then, if we look at private equity, yes, activity has increased again. To your earlier question about notable transactions, outside the classic venture space, we also saw uBlox, which was taken private by Advent International. That deal showed that large PE transactions are possible again. But still, when you talk to most private equity firms, the consensus is the market remains challenging and they're cautious. We're back to the quality discussion. Nobody wants to make mistakes because many PEs are still busy working intensely on their existing portfolio companies. These are not the easy growth companies of 2019 to 2021. Many need real operational work, so buyers remain selective. But yes, there is growing optimism for 2026, cautiously, but quality will absolutely remain the central theme.
When you look at the startups that Everstride is currently supporting in their sale processes, which three factors have the biggest impact on the final valuation?
The first factor, one you can never control, is the market environment. It has a huge impact. We've seen this clearly. Many founders talk to peers who exited in 2019 to 2021. They had completely different market conditions than founders exiting today. Even though 2025 and, in our view, 2026 are more stable again and founders have more visibility, the environment can change quickly and has a material impact on valuation. The second factor, as mentioned, is quality. For SaaS companies specifically, the Rule of 40 is extremely material for valuations, as we discussed. And the third factor is momentum during the process. You absolutely must maintain momentum. If growth suddenly slows or a customer churns unexpectedly, that's extremely difficult, especially now that buyers are more cautious. Momentum has a strong influence on the sale price. And then, of course, preparation. This is where we come in. You can prepare for a process rather than doing everything ad hoc. understand your key KPIs, how you steer them, and we can give input on how an investor actually looks at your company. With preparation, you can mitigate some of the environment risks and influence momentum positively.
You already anticipated the next question a bit. What are the recommendations you at Everstride would make to founders regarding setting up a professional M&A process? And what are typical pitfalls they can avoid?
A lot of founders underestimate one thing, especially in Switzerland. Many transactions ultimately happen with strategic buyers. For many founders, that will be their actual exit path. But what is usually underestimated is how much time it takes to build relationships with strategic buyers and to warm them up to a point where they seriously consider an acquisition. The first reaction of a corporate is almost always, let's explore a partnership, and you need to go beyond that. You need to warm them up so that when an actual M&A process starts, they're capable of participating quickly and meaningfully. You don't need to go to them and say, I want to sell my company. You simply start building a relationship, talk about the product, explore collaborations, understand their pain points. That's extremely important and often overlooked. Another simple but crucial thing, keep your house clean. Keep contracts up to date, keep your financials in order. For very tech-driven founders, this is often a blind spot, but it's extremely important. If you do it continuously, it's easy and doesn't take much time. But if you only start cleaning everything up once there's inbound interest or once you suddenly want to run a process, then it becomes painful and messy. We've seen this many times. And something that still surprises me, founders rarely think about their tax structure early enough. Some make cap table transactions that make no sense from a tax perspective once a sale happens. Others set up personal holding companies because it sounds good, but in Switzerland, that destroys your ability to realize a tax-free capital gain. So get proper tax advice early, it saves enormous problems later. And one more underestimated topic, freelancers. Many startups rely heavily on freelancers. That's okay. But if this isn't set up correctly from a tax and employment law perspective, it can create massive liabilities during an exit. Some startups have dozens of freelancers. If that's not clean, the potential tax back payments can kill a deal. So again, set it up properly and talk to experts early.
Says the man to someone with a personal holding company. If only I had met you earlier, Bernie.
To wrap up, looking ahead, what is your contrarian take for 2026? Something almost nobody has on their radar yet, but that could have massive implications for M&A in the venture space?
Good question. People might have seen the trend, but they don't necessarily connect it to M&A. The common belief is lower interest rates equals more M&A. My thesis is different. I don't think interest rates will fall as quickly as people hope. Inflation is proving more persistent than expected. And whatever happens in the US will inevitably spill over into Europe. But here's the contrarian twist. Higher interest rates could actually accelerate M&A. Why? First, founders and owners will eventually accept that this is the new environment and stop waiting for a magical return to 2021 conditions. Second, higher rates increase financing costs, which will put real pressure on some companies, creating opportunities for buyers. This can reactivate many buyers simply because more attractive opportunities surface. So this non-intuitive dynamic, high rates triggering more M&A, could shape 2026 in a big way.
Super interesting, Bernie. Thank you so much for your insights and for joining us on Burn Rate today. We wish you and Everstride a strong finish to the year and lots of great deals in 2026.
Thanks for having me. Always great to join you guys.
Let's move to the listener question. And this one fits perfectly with what's happening in the market right now. It comes from Niels from Chur. Niels dove deep into the brand new State of European Tech Report 2025 from Atomico, all 183 charts. And he asks, what are your biggest takeaways? What should founders and investors in Europe really pay attention to? I have to say, the report this year is surprisingly positive. I personally expected it to be far more negative. After 2 years of hangover, the European tech ecosystem has its pulse back. Investment up, sentiment improving, a deep tech and defense boom, and interestingly, talent suddenly becoming easier to hire. And at the same time, the same structural weaknesses continue. No exits, pension funds barely invest, and the gender gap is moving in the wrong direction. What impressed me, Europe now stands at almost $4 trillion of ecosystem value, 4 times more than a decade ago. But despite that, we're still blocking ourselves in areas like capital access and market fragmentation. Niels, we'll break this down for you in a ping-pong style conversation. Guy, maybe the most important headline of the report is the return of optimism. 50% of founders and investors are positive about the future again, the highest level since 2021. Do you feel this in your conversations? And what's driving this sentiment shift?
The data absolutely matches what we're seeing day to day. And founders have their energy back and they want to build again. Not because the macro environment is amazing, it isn't, but because the technological breakthroughs are real, especially in AI, defense, and deep tech. Founders feel this is the moment small teams can move massive levers again. Yes, capital costs are high, but the return on innovation is so strong right now that it simply outweighs everything else. Max, the report shows that 36% of European VC capital in 2025 went into deep tech, almost double the share of the 2021 boom. Why now? And is this real or just temporary AI hype?
If we look at Europe overall, it's actually quite logical that access to talent has become easier. The big US tech companies laid off massive numbers of people and implemented hiring freezes. And at the same time, many unicorns from the boom years are either stagnating, have been scaled down, or are kind of walking around zombie style. So a lot of talent is back on the market, and people are actively looking for meaningful missions again. For startups, this means it's suddenly possible to get A players very early at reasonable packages, reasonable salaries, and equity incentives. In my view, that's a historic opportunity. A pretty tough point in the report is the topic of exits, Max. 43% of investors say missing M&A options prevent them from deploying more capital. How big is this problem really? And what does it mean for founders who want to raise in 2026? Yeah, that's a fascinating question. And honestly, yes, we have a structural problem. Europe and Switzerland as well has fantastic early stage financing, but very thin exit markets. Too few strategic buyers, highly fragmented industries, and especially weak IPO structures. I recently read an interesting article in the German Handelsblatt. Do you know which country is the IPO leader in Europe?
I didn't read the report, but I'd guess France, Paris Exchange?
Nope, it's Sweden.
And
if you dig into it, Sweden has had an incredible number of IPOs recently. It's really surprising that a country like Sweden manages this. And we don't. Germany also can't manage it, although Germany has so many exciting companies. And still, they can't create a real stock exchange environment for younger companies. They actually had one, the Neuer Markt, but that ended badly for all the reasons we know. Still, it's super interesting that Sweden pulls it off. Now, what does this mean for founders? First, fundraising will become much more selective. VCs deploy less, not because they don't want to, but because their own LPs are waiting for liquidity. That's the bottleneck right now. Second, the storytelling around the exit becomes incredibly important. If you have a clear M&A case, strong product, valuable data, defensible IP, you have a massive advantage in fundraising. I think 2026 will bring more activity because AI infrastructure players are moving into acquisition mode, but it remains a structural weakness in Europe. Niels, thanks again for your question. The report is really essential reading this year. Europe is recovering, deep tech is exploding, talent is coming back, but the structural capital bottlenecks remain. For founders, this means use the momentum, sharpen your story, and make crystal clear why your company is an essential part of Europe's tech future.
The link to the report, you'll find it in our newsletter next week. So make sure to subscribe. You'll find the link on our LinkedIn page. Now let's move on to the transactions of the week. In this episode, we're covering the deals of the past week, or actually the past few days since our last recording. We already discussed the 50 million round from Flexion, a huge milestone. But not the only mega deal of the last days, right, Max?
Exactly. Distal Motion from Lausanne raised $150 million in a Series G. You rarely see companies in Switzerland stay private that long. The company develops the Dexter surgical robot. Let me read this quickly. A system for minimally invasive soft tissue surgery, optimized specifically for smaller operating rooms as a mobile, flexibly integratable robot that works without any structural modification of the OR. Did I explain that correctly, Guy?
Yeah, that was spot on. Perfect, Max.
So what makes Dexter special?
The big advantage is really the combination of a compact footprint and the hybrid workflow. Surgeons can switch seamlessly between laparoscopic and robotic techniques. The sterile operating concept allows very direct interaction inside the OR, and Dexter is already in clinical use in Europe and the US. Nearly 3,000 patients have been treated with it. I'm reading that here. The system strongly targets the expansion of robotic interventions in ambulatory surgery centers, ASC, which are becoming increasingly important. Who led the round, Max?
Lead investor was Revival Healthcare Capital, a US specialist for scalable medtech commercialization. At least that's what their website says. Existing investors joined as well. The $150 million will be used mainly to accelerate US commercialization, clinical programs, product developments, and expanded presence in the ASC market. Any new hires?
Yes, absolutely. Distal Motion brought on Chas McCann as executive chairman, a heavy hitter in medtech. For those who don't know him, he led Apollo Endosurgery and Silk Road Medical and guided both through massive growth phases. His go-to-market and scaling experience will be incredibly important for the US expansion. And with the latest FDA clearance in gynecology plus product enhancements, Dexter has major momentum.
Exactly. I've always asked myself, what does it take to win in robotics? And with all cases that succeed, you see the same pattern. First, a focused product with clear use cases. Second, targeted markets. And third, enough funding to truly play at the scale of the big players. And that last one, that's exactly what we discussed earlier. It's the limiting factor in Europe. Distal Motion now has 150 million to really go global.
They've now raised nearly 450 million total, one of the fundraising heavyweights of Switzerland. Great story, especially with Michael Friedrich, a Bernese CEO for a long time. Really nice to see. From Lausanne, we head to Zurich, but we stay in robotics. The security drone startup Sunflower Labs announced three milestones at once. Nationwide FAA approval for BVLOS flights in the US, a new interactive configuration tool, and a $16 million Series B. The round was led by none other than Sequoia Capital. The team is around seven people working between Zurich and San Francisco. Max, what exactly does Sunflower Labs do?
Yeah, I looked into it a bit, and what I find exciting is this. They developed what they call the Beehive system. It's a fully autonomous AI-based security drone network, and according to them, it's currently the only system that's already broadly deployed, from large private estates to logistics centers and industrial sites. That's usually the big problem with drone startups. Super innovative tech, but barely any real-world deployment. Here, it's different. The drone flies automated patrols, detects objects via computer vision, and reacts without human control. And they've increased their autonomous missions by a factor of 10 over the last year. What exactly does this new FAA approval mean for them?
It's honestly a game changer. The FAA now allows them nationwide BVLOS operations, so flights beyond visual line of sight, plus flying over people and vehicles, plus operations in low visibility conditions. And all of that nationwide without needing a special waiver each time. That means customers can legally and scalably operate Beehive across the US. From a regulatory perspective, that's huge. And then they also launched a new digital product, right?
Yes, and I think it's super clever. They built a property configuration tool. You enter your address, see your property boundaries, place the hives, see the coverage, simulate response times, and you can even add remote operator services. So anyone can immediately see how the system works on their own site. That's important because security products usually require a ton of explanation. Here, not so much. Who else invested besides Sequoia?
Alarm.com, Drone Fund, then from Switzerland Gentian Investments, once again with very good timing, plus Waserstream Ventures, Atlas Ventures, and Daybreak Ventures. The capital goes into AI improvements, international expansion across Europe, the US and Latin America, and a deeper integration with Alarm.com, which has a massive dealer network.
Gentian, remind me, who is that again?
Elian Kuhl.
Elgin, somehow you always show up in these rounds. Congrats, really not bad. Good, let's move to the capital city, Bern. We have a deep tech update and a success story from our ventures, which we definitely want to mention here. SpaceTech Technology AG has raised 9.6 million Swiss francs, a mix of new equity from existing investors, a technology fund guarantee, and a growth credit from UBS. SpaceTech develops time-of-flight mass spectrometry for industrial applications, inspired by space technology. Where does the company stand today? You know them quite well.
Yes, we know them very well. With our ventures, we financed their very first round. Back then, the Start Angels were also involved. Plus, I know many of the early investors personally. SpaceTech has built an integrated TORF-MS system, and it's already running inside some of the world's most advanced semiconductor fabs. The technology provides real-time gas analysis during processing, during lithography, etching, or when coating silicon wafers. This increases yields, reduces scrap, and therefore measurably lowers CO2 emissions. The tech fund confirmed these environmental and performance benefits in their due diligence, and that's exactly why investor confidence keeps growing.
Yes, and the timing is perfect. In the chip industry, nanometer precision, sustainability, and process stability are becoming absolutely essential. And without systems like SpaceTech's, it becomes almost impossible to maintain those standards reliably. How does the team look currently?
They strengthened the team significantly. Newly on board are Samuel Rensing as COO, Niklas Ehrmann as CTO, and Gunnar Schröder as CCO. All highly experienced people from semiconductor engineering, high-tech operations, and scientific instrumentation. That's crucial because SpaceTech is now entering global rollout mode and must scale both production and customer success.
Yes. And as Maximilian Rottenberger himself says, they're entering the decisive growth phase right now. This financing gives them the reach to push the tech roadmap, global deployments, and sustainability initiatives all at the same time.
And maybe a thank you here to Maximilian as well for sending us the press release in advance. It only goes public the day after tomorrow. But of course, by the time listeners hear this episode, it will already be live. And to everyone else, please keep sending us these announcements early so big rounds like this don't fly under the radar. Now let's move from space directly to agriculture, to Vivint Biosignals, a deep tech case from the agri sector. They build wearables for plants. They raised 7.5 million euros coming from the agri investment fund, Horticube. Let me read this one. I think it's some Irish or Welsh fund, and several Swiss private investors. Vivint is a pioneer in plant electrophysiology, interpreting the electrical signals of plants in real time. Max, what's behind this?
Yes, as we all know, plants can also be stressed. Plants constantly emit internal electrical signals when they experience stress from pests, disease, drought, nutrient deficiency, whatever. And Vivint uses AI to interpret these biosignals. They can detect plant stress days to months before any symptoms become visible to the human eye. That's a huge step for precise, sustainable agriculture. And they are the first in the world to commercialize this technology in the field. In 2025, they launched their outdoor platform, which now monitors more than 1,000 hectares across Europe.
Not bad. It gives farmers a massive advantage. Early intervention, more yield stability, and lower resource usage. And Vivint doesn't just work with farmers, but also crop protection companies, fertilizer manufacturers, irrigation solution providers, and even plant breeders to see how plants react to inputs, nutrients, oxygen, fertilizer, and to different varieties, live and in situ. How do investors describe the opportunity?
The Agri Investment Fund calls it the beginning of a new era, because decision-making in agriculture finally becomes plant-driven instead of purely visual or intuitive. They see both economic upside and ecological impact. And Vivint has now built the world's largest data set of plant biosignals, which gives them a huge competitive edge.
I always find it fascinating how broadly technology can apply, from the Fitbit to a wearable for plants that keeps everything healthy from tomatoes to berries to apples to potatoes. Let's move to the final transaction. Again, Bern. We rarely see venture kick in our transactions segment, but good things take time, as we say in Bern. Taste Omix completed Venture Kick Stage 3 and received 150,000 Swiss francs. The UniBern spin-off develops Peak Aroma, a natural flavor enhancer that creates depth and intensity without salt, sugar, or synthetic additives.
Did you just say good things take time in Bernese dialect? I need to remember that. I mean, I'm from Bern too, right?
Yes, and that means much slower.
So the interesting part is the mechanism. Peak Aroma prolongs activation of the kokumi receptor. That makes food taste fuller and rounder without changing the flavor profile. For producers, that means better flavor retention with less salt, sugar, and fat, and lower costs.
Yeah, and with the funding, they're now scaling production to food-grade volumes, finalizing industry pilot projects, and preparing market entry in the DACH region.
So that's it for this episode of Bern Rate, the VC Insider podcast. If you want to support us, subscribe to our newsletter and share it in your network. Thanks for listening. We wish you a great weekend. Take care and goodbye.